Okay, so my guest today is Mathias Maas. Mathias is a doctoral researcher at the University of Copenhagen's AI and Legal Disruption Research Unit and a research affiliate with the Governance of AI program at Oxford University's Future of Humanity Institute. His research focuses on safe and beneficial global governance strategies for emerging transformative AI systems. This involves, in part, a study of the requirements and pitfalls of international regimes for technology arms control, non-proliferation, and the conditions under which these are legitimate and effective. Welcome to the show, Mathias.
Thanks a lot for having me, John. Excited to get to chat again, and also as someone who's actually listened to the podcast in the past, I'm very happy to get the chance to be on it today.
Yeah, you're like the Courtney Cox being invited on stage in Bruce Springsteen's famous video for Dancing in the Dark.
Exactly.
Okay, so we're going to talk about a paper you've been working on in the recent past. It was once called How Will Artificial Intelligence Disrupt International Law, but I think you've changed the title to something like...
I change it every few weeks or so. So if people have suggestions, I'll take those as well.
The most recent title is something like International Law Does Not Compute. I wanted to talk about this paper because I've interviewed a lot of people who are interested in the regulatory challenges and effects of AI at a domestic and national level. And I've also read some stuff and had some interviews about kind of the existential risks and benefits of AI at a global scale. But apart from some of the stuff on, you know, killer robots and laws of war, I haven't really seen much written about AI and its impact on international law. And that's why I think your paper is interesting and worth talking about. And I also think you do a good job developing a framework for thinking about the various ways in which AI could affect the international legal structure. So I want to try and articulate and proceed through that framework in our conversation today.
Yeah, sounds great. I mean, also, I want to caveat that it is indeed, as you mentioned, sort of some recent work. So some of that is a bit experimental, and I'm still sort of developing and stress testing it. But I've been very excited. The early responses from people I've spoken with are generally quite good.
Yeah, so this is a work in progress, and it's something that's developing. Yeah. Let's start with just some basic warm-up questions about international law. So, you know, the concept or idea of international law is familiar to you and to me to some extent. But I think some people might be confused about the nature of international law and how it differentiates it from national law. So maybe you could start by just explaining that distinction.
Right. So one thing, of course, is also I have impartially sort of international law and also international relations background. So I think that sometimes does color some of my analysis or views. The international law 101 is basically that the international legal system is consent-based and based on state sovereignty. That means that sort of the big difference in sort of from national law is that in international law, there's no single sort of enforcer, so no international police force really, or a mandatory judicial system that can enforce the law. And also there's sort of different sort of sources that determine international law. So there are three primary sources that are international treaties in the first place. Secondly, it's state customs, sort of state behavior. How do states implicitly generally seem to act around a certain topic? And thirdly, it's sort of general principles of law, which include sort of principles of good faith or in terms of interpretation, as well as certain sort of binding norms, such as bans on slavery or genocide. And in addition, you can have judicial decisions from international courts can be applied as a sort of subsidiary means or means of interpreting what the law is. But there's no enforcement, and also there's less of a hierarchy of legal norms as opposed to a domestic context where you have like constitutional norms as well. Now, international law, it's been having sometimes a bit of a rough time, so people can be skeptical about it. I also think it's important to sort of caveat that it's sort of it's easy to look at the cases, the very visible cases where it fails. It's harder to see all sorts of negative examples where it has either prevented the outbreak of conflict or where it has sort of reduced the sort of transaction costs or increased sort of economic productivity, efficiency, and growth, or where it has actually managed to secure human rights. So it certainly doesn't have a spotless track record, but there is generally a sense that it provides powerful normative coordination points for states to agree with, states to an extent expect others to abide by it. Of course, you can debate whether that will continue to be so, whether international law will continue to be so successful and resilient in the future. And it's actually part of what my argument ends up engaging with, sort of what is the effect of AI on this structure. But so on the whole, I wouldn't want to be too cynical or pessimistic about it, actually.
Yeah, so I mean, I think the key points there are that international law is this consent-based system and doesn't have a clear enforcer. And that leads some people to be quite cynical about it and to think that it is largely about the projection of power. So for a long time, and this may be less true in the future, the US was viewed as the global policeman, so to speak, that the US was the ultimate enforcer of international law just because it was the most powerful country. There may be some retreat from that now. I think your point about undue cynicism about international law is well made too, that it has had some positive role in shaping the international trade and the protection of human rights over the past 60 to 70 years, and it's important that we don't lose sight of that fact. And it's not like domestic or national legal orders have spotless track records either, so that's something to always bear in mind in this conversation too.
Yeah, and I think, and also one sort of final point on that is also that at some level, the international legal order is also sort of, it seeks to preserve and secure both peace as well as justice. But at the same time, given that it's based on state interests, so there are certain sort of arrangements in terms of sort of like perhaps sort of veto power for certain states in Security Council and not for others that are in some sense unequal. And I guess sort of it is important to also consider the circumstances under which international law will prioritize peace or stability or conflict resolution over perhaps what might be seen as the most sort of just or equitable resolutions, although that's a more general sort of argument in the philosophy of law, of course.
This is where the relationship between international law and international relations also comes to the fore. And as you mentioned, you have a background in both. Let's move on, though, to talk about technology and international law. So one of the things that you mentioned in your paper, which is, I think, very valuable and useful, is that technology has always had a fairly significant impact on the international legal order. And in fact, you can trace the development of key features of the international legal order to particular technological developments. Maybe you could give some examples of that historical relationship.
Yeah, so there, of course, in part, this is sometimes a bit hard to interrogate because the development of international law it can be to an extent overdetermined by numerous sort of political and other and social and sort of ideas of the time. But there's been a number of work that sort of suggests indeed that there is quite a strong relation between technological development and the sort of the creation and modification or the structure for international law structures. And so one point that's, for instance, made is that Colin Picker has an article in that where he discusses the writings of Hugo Grotius and Francesco de Vitoria, who are sort of considered the fathers of international law. And many of the problems that they concerned themselves with, which were issues over sort of securing the freedom of the high seas, the Hugo Grotius wrote the Mare Liberum, the sort of as a freedom for all states to traverse, or in the case of Vitoria, sort of thinking about the rights of how Spain should treat native peoples in the New World. These problems only arose because of certain advances in ship navigation and ballistics technology, which both for the first time allowed the development of global transoceanic commerce networks and sort of colonization projects, but also sort of force projection capabilities for navies, which for the first time actually made it possible for states to deny access to the high seas. And so the emergence of those technologies sort of created this global community that had these states that had access to each other and engaged with each other, and with that also the need to have sort of common standards amongst themselves. And so, and likewise, if you look at sort of major systemic sort of landmarks in the history of international law, a lot of these came about because of new technology or technology that existed but that now proliferated, which led to really unanticipated bloodshed in major systemic wars. So one discussion is over the proliferation of gunpowder weaponry in the, the 30 Years' War, which contributed to the willingness to engage in the Treaty of Westphalia, which sort of held as the foundation of the modern state. Similarly, the horrors of World War I trench warfare led to the establishment of the League of Nations or the Permanent Court of International Justice, and also the nuclear shadow of the Second World War sort of gave the impetus for the states to engage with the founding of the United Nations. And you can, in the 20th century, you can even see an even tighter connection between new technological innovation, which sort of gives the focus for entirely new legal regimes, So laws that govern space or the moon, or laws that focus on new technologies like nuclear weapons or non-proliferation regimes. But you also see that it affects provisions in international regimes on, well, fishing laws. So the caps on how much and how far and how deep states are allowed to fish, as well as the general law of the sea. And more indirectly, finally, you can see that in the last few decades, internet and social media have begun to shape the sort of indirect negotiation process of international treaties. So whereas this once is a bit of a state affair behind closed doors, you see that in cases like the Ottawa Mine Ban Treaty or the Paris Climate Accords, citizens or non-state actors sort of as NGOs are able to shape debates, they're able to provide evidence of state custom or of certain issues that need to be dealt with. And so technology has had this long history of affecting both the problems that international law engages with, how international law engages it through the types of regimes and principles, and what principles are actually viable.
Yeah, and I think that's an important point to bear in mind when we discuss the impact of AI on the international legal order. So let's start to look at that topic now by discussing the definition or concept of AI that you use in your paper. There are lots of these concepts being thrown around, but you focus in particular on something you call globally disruptive artificial intelligence. Now, what is globally disruptive artificial intelligence, and how does it differ from some of the other forms of AI that are discussed in debates about the ethics of technology?
Right. So on the one end, of course, it can appear a bit sort of spurious because there are these many definitions, these many terms, and also acronyms. And so why would we need another acronym to add on that? For me, I consider globally disruptive AI to sort of sketch out this class of systems that includes sort of currently prototype systems, plausibly imminent systems, and also if you want to extend that at the limit, it would include possible future general or even superintelligent AI capabilities. And the criteria for this is not so much how intrinsically general or developed the system are, but rather that in certain applications, they create these global challenges that, as these systems are deployed, you require global level governance or global coordination to effectively address them. And that can include systems like military cyber warfare systems or systems that can drive extensive technological unemployment, or you need, there's a range of systems in sensing or in the tracking of, so I think the US has been working on self-driving ships, or I don't know if you'd call it driving, that can be used to track ballistic missile submarines. Those systems can end up undercutting nuclear deterrent stability. Now, so this concept has a lower threshold than some of the longer term notions of transformative AI that are sometimes discussed. So transformative AI is sometimes considered as AI that has a similar impact to the Industrial Revolution, either in its sort of direct impact or the trajectory change. What I more want to focus on is that there's a class of AI systems that pose governance challenges that are not domestic, like self-driving cars, perhaps, but that you can discuss them in a governance context also without sort of drawing international lawyers or policymakers into more speculative or long-term debates over general capabilities or an absolute sort of industrial revolution level transformations. It's more of like a middle road that enables us to structurally think about the interface of this technology with international law in the coming decades. And I think a similar approach has been taken by, for comparison, by Alan Defoe at the Governance of AI program in Oxford, who wrote up this recent document, AI Governance and Research Agenda, which also sort of focuses on nearer term, quite disruptive capabilities that global governance in some form or another has to engage with.
Yeah, I think the way I would see it or interpret it is that you're not to understand or appreciate this concept, you don't need to engage in speculations about kind of human level intelligence or super intelligence, or as you say, AI being some kind of general purpose technology that transforms how everything gets done around the world. You just have to focus on forms of artificial intelligence that spill over beyond the confines of the national or domestic. And aren't we already familiar with similar kinds of technological development that have necessitated some sort of global solution? I mean, I guess, you know, satellite technology to some extent requires a global framework for governance, debates around climate change. Also, clearly, you need a global solution to that problem, not a domestic or national solution. Certain kinds of disease management, virus outbreaks, yeah, and so forth. You need global governance solutions, not just domestic or national solutions.
And yeah, exactly. Yeah. Oh, yeah. You could definitely also link this sort of longer lasting debates over global public goods or sort of shared risks as well. And even sort of going back to a neat discussions of nuclear nonproliferation or arms control or other weapons of mass destruction, to a lesser extent, perhaps also debates over sort of cyber warfare regulation or sort of the sometime lack of hard law on the international level. So definitely.
So I think that's important here, because even though some of what we're going to talk about is or will seem speculative and far-fetched, it doesn't necessarily have to be speculative and far-fetched to require some kind of global response or treatment.
Right.
Right. So let's move on then and talk about the ways in which the AI could disrupt or affect the global or international legal order. Now, you divide this into three main sections in your paper. So you focus on the ways in which it could develop international law, legal development, the ways in which it could displace international law, and then finally the ways in which it could destruct or destroy international law.
Right.
So let's start with that first idea of legal development and how we might change and evolve the international legal order. So what is that concept of legal development, first of all? What do you mean by that?
Right. So legal development is perhaps basically the most modest or mundane type of change. It's basically saying that there is this new technology or that creates this new situation, and the law as it stands by itself is sort of inadequate or unclear dealing with this new situation. And so we will need to undertake some process of change, so new law, new treaty laws, perhaps new judgments of international courts that can clarify the new legal status. And I'm drawing here actually on a model of law and technology that was developed by Lyria Moses-Bennett. She develops this model in the context of domestic lawmaking, and I try to sort of lift it up or apply it to international law. She argues that technology affects law in sort of two ways. It creates new entities, or it enables new types of behavior. Those are not appropriately covered by the existing laws. And she argues that the introduction of this new technology as such creates four types of legal problems or situations. So the first one is basically there is a need for new special laws that are tailored to this new conduct. The second is what's called legal uncertainty. So it may not be clear whether the existing or whether this new conduct is actually commanded or mandated by the law. So the laws seem to apply, but it's not clear how. The third category is sort of it's an incorrect scope. So the existing laws, they are incorrectly under or over inclusive of the new behavior. So you could have something where, I don't know, say in a domestic context, you could say that maybe we get motorized wheelchairs for people. And then the existing law says, oh, but we can't have motor vehicles on curbs, so therefore they're not allowed to drive around in local areas. And clearly that doesn't seem sensible. And so you should add new caveats or exceptions to allow perhaps mechanized wheelchairs to also use the curb. And the fourth category is legal obsolescence, which is basically that the existing rules are justified either explicitly or implicitly on the basis of a certain premise that doesn't actually apply anymore given this new technology, and so we need to reconsider our legal structure.
So let's go through each of those four possibilities now in relation to artificial intelligence. So if we go to the first one, that the creation of this new technology is going to result in the need for new laws, could we have some examples of how that might apply in the case of artificial intelligence? What new laws might we need?
In a sense, the need for new laws is the most straightforward example. It's something that international law has a long track record in creating what's called sui generis, so specific laws for new technology. So in the past, we've had technologies like nuclear weapons or ballistic missile defense or space travel. As these became viable, we didn't try to apply existing sort of norms or frameworks to them so much, or not at least directly. Instead, we formulated specific regimes or treaty regimes, of course, in accordance with existing sort of norms. But sort of the international community decided that it was necessary to formulate explicit treaties to account for these new cases. And so you could say that globally disruptive AI, or even sort of any existing types of AI, they could allow for new types of behavior. So say the deployment of fully autonomous weapon systems, which is the big debate that's going on now, or the manipulation of populations through computational propaganda, where basically the community is able to come together and say, this is hazardous, these systems need to be prevented. So there's no underlying sense of legal confusion about existing categories. It's rather that the community perhaps identifies a legal gap that needs to be filled in. And of course, it's another question entirely whether this gap, like politically, can be filled in terms of these sort of international political incentives of state parties.
Let's move on then to the second idea, this notion of legal uncertainty. So there's a law that could potentially apply to this technology, but there's some lack of clarity about how it could apply. I mean, how would that arise in the case of artificial intelligence? Could you give maybe an example of that uncertainty?
There could be uncertainty when it's unclear if specific new conduct is sort of within international law, within existing concepts or categories or norms, whether that conduct is sort of allowed or prohibited. And I guess the archetypal case is discussions over autonomous weapon systems, where people are seeing that the opacity, the unpredictability, or the autonomy of these systems can create uncertainty over legal concepts such as the command responsibility of commanders in the context of war crimes, or control or attribution. And there are actually scholars that suggest that, well, international law has a lot of case law development or a lot of case law precedent in sort of thinking about when are states responsible for, say, actors that are or agents that are acting on their behalf. So, say, militant, non-state militant movements that are being supported by states, or indeed commanders that are devolving responsibility to their soldiers. So international law might be able to resolve those questions, but of course it has to be applied or specified or clarified either by international courts or by state practice. What actually is the international legal view on this new behavior?
Yeah, I mean, so this is kind of a classic problem with all new technologies or all new social developments, is that we might have pre-existing laws that can cover them, but we're not really sure whether they cover them. And until that uncertainty is resolved by somebody, you have this problem. And this is often as well why there's a temptation to create new laws, just to make it unambiguous and clear that this new technology
right.
and the new conduct is covered.
Yeah, even though, of course, it might be more intractable to get enough consensus to create new laws, but
I mean, I might come back to that point in a moment.
Right.
How about we go on to the third idea though as well, the scope uncertainty, or the problem of over or under inclusiveness of laws. There's an interesting example here actually to do with company law and the recognition of AI personhood, which I'm quite interested in, so maybe you could go into that.
Right, I could see that also, of course, given your previous interests also in discussions of personhood or status for AI. So there's an interesting, the third category is essentially a risk that the existing law ends up having the wrong scope, so that it's either over-inclusive of the new AI capabilities in ways that we think are legitimate, or under-inclusive. The case that has been developed is, I think it was sort of a paper by Byron, where they suggested that by using existing US company law, you can incorporate a limited liability company, and then you can actually put an algorithm in charge of it, which sort of functionally, putting aside all the moral debates over robot personhood, functionally that would give this algorithm a certain type of legal personhood. And there has been work suggesting that, well, that could actually be used by companies or by criminals to escape sort of responsibility or liability. And of course, one level of over-inclusiveness where we're saying, well, just because you can hack your way, just because you can find a legal exploit that allows you to give personhood to these robots or sort of to these algorithms, that's not what actually was meant by the spirit of the law, and therefore we need to patch that. There's also a second layer, which is that Thomas Burry has suggested that, okay, if you get this, if you conduct this trick where you give personhood to an algorithm, what they call a artificially intelligent entity, or I think I forget the precise term they use for that. His point is that, so the EU, for instance, has laws on the mutual recognition, or case laws on the mutual recognition of personhood, which means that if you were to do a similar trick in one EU country to sort of register an algorithm and give it functional legal personhood, then all of the other countries, all the other EU member states have to end up recognizing the personhood of this AI. And so we could basically decide that is sort of that this type of inclusion doesn't reflect democratic deliberation that we've decided that we want to extend either on moral or pragmatic grounds, personhood to AIs. It's basically an exploit that we think is not appropriate and that should be patched by new regulation.
Yeah, and again, this is kind of a familiar problem to legal systems, and this is what lawyers are oftentimes paid to do, is to find loopholes or features of the existing legal framework that either don't cover a particular type of conduct or do cover it. So this is the point here, is that we have this idea of personhood for non-human entities, for corporations, and that could be exploited by artificially intelligent entities as well. And I mean, Bayern's argument is interesting, but it's quite involved and relies on some technical features of the US corporate code. But I do recommend people read it, because it's an interesting illustration of how existing legal frameworks could be hacked or to allow for the recognition of AI personhood.
And it's hard to waterproof them in advance fully. Like, there's, as you say, there's sort of the bread and butter of lawyers that are always going to find. There's no clear way to future-proof law to these types of problems, except by making the law like so general that you can't really meaningfully apply it.
What about then this last problem of obsolescence? And I think you initially explained that as that the underlying premise for the law becomes irrelevant given the new technological reality. But there are different ways in which it can become irrelevant, and it might be important to distinguish between those different ways. So maybe you could outline that idea.
Well, so laws essentially, I mean, maybe very generally, have at least three types of core underlying assumptions. One is the assumption that the conduct that we're regulating is actually conduct that's happening. The second type of assumption is that certain normative premises or assumptions that used to inform the formulation of the law are no longer relevant or achievable or possible. And the third assumption is that a rule is no longer cost effective to enforce. And so, to give some example, could argue that AI, the introduction of AI, could make certain conduct obsolete or basically no longer present. So if you take the example of international humanitarian law that deals with the reduction of harm to non-combatants, one category of non-combatants is prisoners of war. Now, it's maybe a bit of a contrived argument, but you could argue that in as far as the introduction of more AI systems and more AI platforms allows our militaries to take soldiers away from the direct battlefield, we're going to see less soldiers getting captured. And so, in a very mundane level, that basically means that the subset of international humanitarian law norms that deal with protecting prisoners of war become, well, obsolete in the sense that there are no longer many prisoners of war being taken. The second one, to the assumptions underpinning the law, the normative assumptions, it's basically, so there is, for instance, a right, which, to be fair, is not sort of considered an enforceable right, but it's an aspirational right that in different human rights treaties, that human beings have a right to work. And if we are indeed going to see increasing technological employment to an increasing larger level and larger proportion of the population, this assumption that a country or community could, in principle, give productive employment to all of its members is going to be increasingly frustrated. And that is going to make, well, some of these concepts and frameworks obsolete. And more pragmatically, it may also just basically make a lot of the legal frameworks developed by bodies like the International Labour Organization and like soft law, it can make that a bit more obsolete, basically bypass that, because we need a different solution than assuming that we could give enough employment to everyone. And the third category of obsolescence is basically that the rule can no longer be cost-effectively enforced. I think in the domestic context, this is discussions over, well, perhaps you could discuss where certain copyright laws are no longer easy to enforce given the ease which the internet allows you to spread around and copy and distribute information. In an AI context, an international law context, you could think of examples where there's been discussion about so-called deepfakes or the ability to create fake but very plausible seeming video or audio footage using machine learning systems. You could think of cases where such types of applications make it very easy for bad actors or interested parties to create fake material sort of indicating human rights abuses or war crimes, and basically inundate media actors or observers or sort of human rights agencies with this type of sort of fake material. So then you're simultaneously undercutting public trust or credibility in the types of analysis, because you're never quite sure if sort of the material is genuinely real. That's a general problem of sort of the fake news. But also you can basically bury these types of bodies in a large administrative workload. Now, I'm not sure how big of of a threat this particular example really is, because for one thing, certain international courts don't take video evidence into consideration. Secondly, there are actually certain types of organizational steps that sort of observer agencies can take to really verify the reliability of their materials. But it basically suggests that AI could be used in contexts to render cost-effective monitoring or enforcement of existing legal frameworks a lot harder, or even just basically inviolable.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting example, and it's one of the more kind of maybe speculative ideas in the paper, but also the one that fascinated me, because you also see the potential for debates at a national level about fake news and the sense that we're all living in our own filter bubbles, affecting how international law gets enforced or monitored. And I can see a possible spillover effect from the national level to the global level in that respect. Another thing that occurred to me, though, that might be another example of that is just, you know, principles around sovereignty and non-interventionism being less practically enforceable due to cyber warfare, right, or developments in kind of cyber interventionism. And I think we already see some of that happening with the kind of US-Russia example.
I think actually one discussion in the context of cyber weapons today already is that given that it's hard to do attribution reliably, that makes the laws surrounding state aggression or indeed deciding whether this qualifies as armed attack, that makes it a lot harder to qualify and enforce. And even if you're clear about the kinetic damage, it's a lot harder to understand for sure who you have to target with the sanctions or in response.
Yeah, just maybe one final question here on this idea of development, and this was a more general question I wanted to ask. So I mentioned to you in correspondence in advance, there's, you know, this famous paper by Easterbrook about the law of the horse and the law of cyberspace, which in essence argues that we shouldn't really think about developing special laws to deal with new technologies, that we have existing laws that are sufficiently abstract and tech neutral to address these new developments. I mean, I don't know if there is a good answer to this question, but like, what's your sense about the development of the international legal order in light of these kind of technological changes? Should we really be focusing on having a tech neutral abstract legal framework, or is that just always going to be impractical because of the uncertainty that it generates?
So I do find a very sort of interesting argument. And I mean, and there has, of course, on the more conceptual level, also been sort of rebuttals or counter-arguments by Lawrence Lessig on sort of the law of the horse. But on a very pragmatic level, I think that the idea of developing or having technology-neutral regulation might hold better in sort of domestic or national contexts, or perhaps sort of regional, such as with the EU and the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation sort of body of law, than it might in the context of international law, specifically because application of international law and reapplication and expansion depends on consensus. And this consensus is sort of achievable in a domestic sort of like, sure, we understand that if we have technology that deals with privacy violations by regular big data, then perhaps it should also extend to privacy violations by use of AI. But it might be much more contested by states in an international law context, especially if the phrasing of like treaties is broad and sort of general and vague, as it must be in the context of technology neutral law. I mean, so one, to give an example, is that the convention on certain conventional weapons, which is sort of trying to restrict certain types of weapons that inflict unnecessary harm or suffering or are indiscriminate. And the route that it took was not to go for sort of perhaps technology neutral law, especially, except perhaps to have these sort of general what type of technologies you would look at. But it has these sort of additional protocols that look at technologies like landmines or blinding lasers that were negotiated and bolted onto it later on. So that's a alternative format where it is sort of negotiated and added on by consensus by states iteratively, rather than sort of asking states to sign on to a technology-neutral regime that they don't know how broadly it's going to be applied down the line and then how it might restrict their capabilities, including sort of very more powerful AI capabilities down the line.
Yeah, that's actually an interesting point about that potential difference and distinction between the national and the regional and the international level when it comes to the idea of neutrality. I hadn't really thought about it in those sense before, but it makes sense that we would require greater certainty and specificity in the international legal order because of the consensus-based nature of the implementation of it. Let's move on, though, to the second idea then. So we've discussed legal development. What about legal displacement then? So what is displacement? And in your paper, in particular, you talk about the distinction between ways in which AI might lead to the automation of the international legal order and also then how it might actually replace the international legal order. What do you mean by that distinction?
So this is a distinction where, so in the theory of law, they sometimes distinguish between what are called sort of different modalities of regulation. So that what is meant by that is, how do you get regulatees? So in domestic law, that's people. In international law, that's states. How do you get them to behave in the ways that you want? And traditionally, a lot of law is so-called normative. So you're giving people norms. You tell them to obey them. And if they violate them, you try and punish them or sanction them. But there's also some sort of work, especially drawing on Lawrence Lessig and Brown Swart, that looks at using sort of shifts in what's called architecture. So in the environment of regulatees to shape the choice options are available to them. So you could think of in the context of cyberspace, are people sort of anonymous by default, or do you need to actually register that with the government? And so you're not actually anonymous online. And so there are cases where you can start to use technology to shape behavior. And it's basically, you're no longer giving a norm and telling people to obey. You're basically, indirectly doing non-normative technological management. But to basically sort of step back on that, for AI and legal displacement, I'm sort of asking the question, can AI be used to displace or substitute for aspects of the international legal system? I identify two sort of sub-themes indeed. So legal automation, where the laws are normative. So then I talk about, could AI be used in monitoring or enforcement of international law? And that seems like it could be quite... Sorry.
Let me just come in before you go into the distinction. Yeah. So just to give a clearer example or illustration of the difference between the two things. So let's say you are in charge of a strip of road outside your house or in your workplace, and you want to make sure that people drive more slowly on this road. You could enforce that through norms, where you just have a sign up saying that the speed limit is X, and if you're found breaching the speed limit, you'll be fined or some other punishment or sanction will be imposed on you. That's a fairly classic mode of regulation. Or you could just put in place speed bumps, which force people to drive more slowly. So you're building into the architecture of the environment the kinds of behavior that you want people to engage in. So you're changing the choice architecture of the environment in such a way that you're kind of hard coding in the preferred form of behavior rather than leaving it up to the free will or discretion of the individual to follow the norm. So you're talking about the same kind of distinction when it comes to enforcing international law. You could use the technology to monitor the enforcement of existing norms, or you could use the technology potentially to basically remove discretion or obviate the need for the enforcement and monitoring of norms. So,
exactly. And so I argue that the using AI in automation, so you could use it to enforce normative international law. So on the one hand, we've had a long track record in using technology. So what are nuclear sniffer planes that can fly sort of past sort of the North Korean peninsula to detect whether nuclear tests are going on, or spy satellites, or basic sort of information intelligence or signals intelligence. So we've already used that for a long time to increase our ability to catch and detect violators of international law. And so you could similarly use AI to detect or even to predict violations of international norms. So Berenice Boutin at the Asser Institute in The Hague actually recently did an interesting write-up where she linked to the use of machine learning systems in, for instance, enforcing anti-poaching conventions, counter-poaching in Uganda and Malaysia. Or there's a system called Sentry, which is used to predict and give Syrian citizens advance warning of airstrikes in the Syrian conflict. So that seems like a very plausible use case to use AI and sort of a beneficial use case to use AI to increase our ability to detect violence. relations. I think actually in a previous podcast you did, Miles Brundage similarly discussed the potential to use AI to increase the ability for states to coordinate and to also catch violators of international law or arms control agreements specifically. There is another type of legal automation that I'm more skeptical about, which is to use AI not in the enforcement of international law, but in the sort of production process. And it's, I mean, in a domestic context, we have seen this being used for AI systems that can, well, anything in the US context to undertake sentencing decisions or sort of the risk of reoffense decisions, with, of course, all of the problems of bias that come with that. Similarly, there was some work on sort of predictions of I think so patent allocations. So which party gets granted a patent? But I think using AI in sort of the production of international law or new international law and norms is unlikely, both because international law doesn't really have sufficient data, either sort of enough data, enough case law, or sufficiently homogeneous data to really train a machine learning system on meaningfully. So you would have to posit down the line more sort of human-like or general types of AI systems for something like that to seem plausible. Of course, secondly, international law is of course also very contested. So it seems unlikely that we'd use AI systems to arbitrate on contested topics like the Israeli-Palestine conflict, basically because there are going to be questions about who made the AI system, who programmed it, who trained it, and what are our opportunities to affect its decisions by poisoning the data stream or by affecting it. I could see in a more soft argument, you could argue that, well, AI can help in sort of providing more informed data analysis that you can help to basically tailor governance strategies for problems like climate change. And sure, that is also what the UN, so the Secretary General Antonio Guterres had this strategy this fall, where he basically said that we want to use AI to speed up our progress towards the Sustainable Development Goals in 2030. That seems like a viable use case, but that doesn't seem to be sort of the direct, we're going to automate international law and more sort of we're going to improve perhaps the information with which international law is made.
Yeah, I mean, So it seems like humans will remain very much on the loop and occupying kind of key decision-making roles in international law for the foreseeable future, perhaps in a way that they may not be in the domestic context. But you do actually use an example in the paper, which I thought was kind of interesting, of, is it the Chinese ministry using AI decision support tools to help with negotiation of treaties?
Right, yeah. So there's an interesting example where a few articles over the summer where supposedly the Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs has deployed a system that can look at public statements or look at sort of media statements around in other countries, and it can help them model sort of their own negotiation strategies and get a sense of what are the red lines in terms of the negotiation for other state parties. Of course, the question can be asked, like, is that to what extent are they allowing themselves to rely on this system, or is it more sort of a rhetoric? It could be an interesting case to shape how negotiations are done, although there are, of course, many risks that if I'm the US and I know that the Chinese sort of diplomat AI is monitoring our Twitter feeds to see what is our red line, I could try and figure out sort of, okay, what are the keywords that convince the AI that we are not going to budge on our trade war, or we are not going to give in, and that it's better for them to give in as well. So it seems hard to use a system in a way that you don't have to be concerned about someone spoofing it in a way that is not very useful to you, although it could be used in a advisory capacity. And of course, one problem there is that if people or states perceive that some parties are using AI to model their negotiation strategies, that could really undercut the legitimacy of any sort of bilateral, multilateral agreements that do end up being used. If it's sort of revealed or suspected later on, this shaped negotiation.
Yeah, I mean, sorry, two points kind of occur to me there. One is just that, more of an amusing side note, but like trying to spot any logic or consistency in, you know, Donald Trump's tweets to develop a negotiating strategy might be tricky, even for the most sophisticated AI system. But also, just on your second concern about well, you might result in spoofing or gaming the system. That's true, but it seems to me that's kind of a feature of international negotiations anyway, in that there's a lot of attempts to manipulate and manage judgments and interactions of others.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, definitely. Yeah, that's very true.
Although, I mean, it might be worse if we have all these basically chatbots fighting against each other to develop international negotiation strategies. But it seems like that, I do think that is a little bit more far-fetched or long-term, and I'm not sure if it's going to happen in the near future.
Yeah, I think I share that sentiment, yeah.
What about this idea of replacing the legal order? So, you know, we're not just to enforce existing normative order, but to somehow obviate the need for norms and the enforcement of norms.
Right, yeah, so that draws back indeed to what we were discussing a little while back on the notion of technologically managing the space of options that are available in shaped choice architecture. So that seems a bit, so it seems plausible in the context of regulating citizen behavior. It might seem more far-fetched to apply that to states. I think one example, I'm not sure if it's a good one, it would be to look at so something like blockchain, which supposedly is sort of like as a trustless ledger, it supposedly precludes tampering by most, so not all, but sort of most states sort of shape their behavior the option space that's available to certain states. I'm less sure what it would look like for AI systems. So you could think, of course, on AI surveillance systems that's not really shaping people's options. It's rather saying, well, we'll catch you doing it. I'm wondering what would be examples if it's... So perhaps you could have a AI system that will automatically shut down large parts of... So the US or the Russian internet, if it perceives a given party undertaking a cyber attack. So that's a sort of a credible commitment that you're saying. And of course, I don't think that this is very likely at all to be implemented or for those states to agree to it. But if you had something like that, states didn't see ways to get around it or to hack the system itself, then that would basically be a credible assurance that, well, you basically can't do cyber attacks on the internet because there is a AI cyber sovereign that will immediately interfere. But I don't think... I haven't thought this through very deeply, and it seems unlikely that states would agree to have their choice architecture limited in such a fundamental and irreversible way for them. And also, yeah, given like it's not clear who oversees it and who designs or oversees these systems.
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree that it's highly unlikely that states are going to come to consensus about implementing some kind of technological infrastructure for managing their relationships with one another. I mean, I was thinking that maybe if you could design a perfect weapons defense system or something, that would obviate the need for maybe certain forms of international law of arms, of armed conflict.
Right.
But that is possibly more of an example of legal destruction, which is maybe the next topic to discuss.
I mean, maybe one final example in terms of like technological management, maybe there is actually a case where in the context of nuclear deterrence, where sort of like US policies such as launch and warnings, basically saying if we detect a launch from your site, we are going to immediately launch ourselves. So there's basically no physical way that your missiles could take out our ICBMs while they're still in their silos. I guess that is sort of trying, I mean, it's not really an international law response, of course, but I guess it's a state trying to unilaterally shape the environment in such a way to take certain options off the table and hope, and hopefully, I mean, they hope that this will stabilize nuclear deterrence, although it leaves open opportunities for accidental launch and things like that.
So yeah, let's talk then finally about this idea of legal destruction and the ways in which artificial intelligence might lead to the end of the global legal order or destroy aspects of the global legal order. Now you distinguish between a hard and a soft version of this phenomenon. So maybe you could talk about the soft version first. What does a soft form of legal destruction look like?
I guess there's a soft form would be more something like erosion or perhaps inadequacy. So it basically says that these new types of globally disruptive AI systems and the challenges they raise, they'll create these gaps in the law or these gaps in governance that would require legal development of the sort that we discussed previously. But it's basically saying that even though international law in principle is it would be able to do those types of patches and filling the holes, politically, in practice, it will be unlikely to do so because of certain features of AI. And that basically means that international law will prove largely unable to adapt or govern these problems in a similar way that it has perhaps not fully managed to govern cyber warfare or state cyber warfare. And so that basically erodes the scaffolding of international law. That's basically because there are certain reasons to suspect that AI capabilities in general are quite hard to regulate globally for international law. So in the most general sense, international law is actually quite bad at anticipating the course of technological development and sort of what technologies need regulation. So in the 1960s, there was actually academic proposals for a center of the Earth treaty, sort of anticipating very deep mining that never realized. And in the 1970s, there were proposals to regulate weather control. Do we need a treaty for that? In 1982, we had the Law of the Sea, which had deep seabed mining provisions, which basically assumed that we would have the ability to undertake mining activities very, very deeply below the ocean, which we still don't really have. And so generally, AI is a fast-moving emerging technology, and most of the tools of international law, such as customary international law or even treaties, take many years to sort of to get the consensus on and to crystallize and to develop. And moreover, treaties also require sort of even stakes in the technology, which in the case of AI, we've got a few states such as the US and China that have a definite lead in it. And so it's harder to sort of get a shared sort of multilateral agreement globally that sort of everyone agrees, oh, we have sort of the same stakes, let's regulate this in a safe way. And there's also sort of a need for states to have clear expectations of benefits of sort of entering into agreement. And finally, the ability to verify compliance with agreements, and especially with AI, verifying whether someone is, say, not developing a cyber warfare AI system can be quite hard. It's quite easy to hide software programs. It's harder to inspect them. I think there's the case that Miles Brundage also used of the Volkswagen problem, where you've got software that detects when it's being tested by inspectors. And so this is a soft argument is saying, in principle, international law could do legal development and fix this, but in practice, politically, it's unlikely that this will be addressed on a global level through international law. And so this will not threaten all of international law or other regimes, but in the areas that this creates governance challenges, this will basically it might create some legitimacy concerns, as international law may be perceived to be less adequate to deal with 21st century governance problems.
Yeah, I mean, I have a couple of thoughts on this.
Right.
One idea here is that Francis Fukuyama has written these two books about political order and political decay, and you know, distilling down about 1,200 pages of work, the core of it is that political systems tend towards decay in the long run, that they're drawn back towards, people are drawn back towards their natural impulses and instincts, which is to favor family and friends over distant strangers, in essence. And it's very hard to create a political system that overrides those natural instincts. And so all systems tend toward decay, and that's true at a national level, and he gives lots of arguments for why, let's say, the US is undergoing a kind of political decay at the moment, which means it's just not responsive to new developments and new challenges. There are embedded, entrenched interests that are just very difficult to override. And it seems to me the same is going to be true of the international legal order as well. It's going to have maybe a tendency towards decay. You know, there was this great utopian moment post-World War II where we had the development of the modern international legal order, but over time that has maybe kind of petrified and hardened into something that's less dynamic and adaptable and flexible, and that is tending towards decay. And that creates a problem when we got new disruptive technologies coming on board, is that the international legal order just can't adapt and respond to them. There's also another idea here which I think is interesting, which is that technology itself was one of the causes of this problem of decay. Because things develop so quickly and so fast, people are just unable to keep up with the demands for change, and that leads to this kind of rigidification of the system. So
it's a type of future shock, sort of. We can't keep up with that.
Yes, exactly. It's a future shock idea. So it seems like AI could be actually both the challenge. The soft argument could be revealing those challenges of this tendency towards decay in systems over time, and also may be a cause of that tendency towards decay.
Right. So it's interesting because it would be interesting to think about modeling or tracking trends in such type of decay or sort of slow change in values of the actors that are being regulated. I mean, one sort of pessimistic interpretation of international law would be that indeed, okay, you get major legal innovation and major strengthening of the legal order and norms after a major sort of upheaval or a shock or a systemic war or something. Yeah, very frightening. And then you get this utopian moment where people are like, well, we need to, it's one world or none. We need to secure nuclear weapons or we will not survive for long. I guess there is a sense where, I mean, so this actually starts going into the hard argument for legal destruction. So the soft argument says that, well, states may not be willing or able to reach, sort of politically, to reach the required agreement on AI challenges to resolve those challenges within international law. The hard argument is basically saying that certain states, so not all, but certain states might also, because of their new AI capabilities and their unilateral AI, their ability to unilaterally deploy these, might see a shift in their values away from multilateralism and reciprocity towards unilateralism. And of course, it's sometimes hard to entangle different trends. I mean, there has been a lot of this sort of commentary that we are already independently currently seeing a backlash to multilateralism, cosmopolitanism, and in international law needs, or as you mentioned, perhaps there is this decay of legal systems. But I guess at its most basic, most sort of rational actor type model interpretation, the hard argument for legal destruction would say that there are certain states that lead both in AI development, and they are all sort of, their acquiescence or buy-in is fundamental to the operation of international law. So both the hardware of international law, the sort of the institutions, as well as the software, so the underlying norms, and that insofar as these sort of states sort of they once perceived that they, by buying into international law or by supporting international law, at least to some degree, of course not completely, that they perceived that they secured certain benefits. So that could be domestic security or global stability, it could be prosperity or legitimacy home and abroad, that gives you a certain degree of soft power. And so states like the US or China could previously have believed that they achieve these goals through engagement in or compliance with international order or things like human rights. But if some of these states now perceive that they can actually secure these types of goals by using AI capabilities, so you could think, okay, you can achieve domestic security not by cooperating with foreign intelligence services, but by using your own AI surveillance. You could achieve legitimacy home and abroad through computational propaganda and fake news. You could achieve soft power by having these negotiation support systems as the Chinese are developing. And if you have those substitutes, then that might make certain actors or states more comfortable in sort of relying more on their AI capabilities unilaterally than on being seen to play nice and respect international norms at home or abroad.
Yeah, so there's this sense in which the mastery of the technology could favor isolationism over multilateralism. I mean, hasn't there been, I think it was Putin who effectively said that there's kind of like an AI arms race, and whoever's going to win that race will ultimately control the world order. Or
right, yeah. Although, to be fair, I think in this case, his comments are taking a little bit out of context, because I think the context was that he was speaking sort of encouragingly to children, to high school students at a science fair. So it's basically telling them encouragingly, like, well, continue these projects, you're going to make Russia great. It's sort of different from making a diplomatic statement to the UN. But of course, you do see this perception amongst many parties and states that AI could be sort of a zero-sum arms race. Although the Chinese actually a few months ago have stepped back their rhetoric a little bit. Generally, I mean, I think the hard argument for legal destruction, sort of saying that this is going to lead to unilateralism and states can rely on sort of AI might rather than legal right. I might be a bit sort of hesitant to push that too far, also for reasons where I'm a bit apprehensive about emphasizing sort of unilateral narratives too early. I think that if you really push it to the limit in like sort of the very long term, the hard argument might turn out to be true. So if you think about Nick Bostrom's sort of superintelligence, he discusses, well, a system like that has a decisive strategic advantage. So it's a general AI that's so good at things like cyber warfare or military coordination that you can basically, if you're the US, you can turn out the lights in Beijing or vice versa. And yeah, and you can drop all pretenses of engaging in reciprocal relations. But that is, of course, a very long-term perspective. And even then, I think there's a lot of debate over that if such an AI was developed, you would actually have sort of several states having such advanced AI systems. So that would change the dynamics as well. But I think in the nearer term, it is quite a tall order to get systems that are so capable that you can feel as a state that you can use them to completely substitute for playing well with the international order. And also it is a question, of course, like why wouldn't you to some extent try to retain both as a state? But of course I am maybe perhaps slightly colored by the sense that I think in the nearer term, adopting a very zero-sum framing may not be the most productive way to frame the development of AI or ways to meet the challenges of AI under international law in the coming decades.
I agree with that. I wouldn't be keen on pushing the unilateralist angle because I would worry about its political and social ramifications as well.
It could be a self-fulfilling prophecy. I think there was discussion was in the 90s or where the clash of civilization narratives, where it's a discussion where scholars are saying like, well, even if they're like, whether or not there's something to that narrative, if policymakers start buying into it too much, then we're not going to be in a happy place.
Yeah, exactly. So that'll be my fear with it as well. Maybe just like one last question, just to wrap up the various threads of the conversation. I mean, what do you think the future really does hold? You've kind of outlined a spectrum of possibilities. Do you have any gut instinct yourself about is legal development and increased automation the most likely outcome, or do you have another sense of where we're going?
Oh, wow. I find it hard to get a very good sense of the coming decades. I mean, that's the problem of prediction. I do think that it's easy for people to perhaps too rapidly count out sort of international law or state-based law too rapidly, sort of to say that, well, AI is made much more by companies, by private sector, and therefore states aren't really in the relevant position anyway. I do think that you could have regimes that carry enough sort of weight and legitimacy amongst a wide range of states to develop this in more positive directions. Yeah, I think this also depends very much on the sequence in which sort of capabilities get unlocked, if that's not a weird metaphor, in the coming decades. So whether we're going to see what's going to come first is something like surveillance capabilities, or whether it's more something like cyber warfare capabilities that turn out to be most scalable and accessible, or whether it's something that helps states make sort of enforce international law, so monitoring of agreements. And I would definitely be eager to see more investment or exploration of initiatives like those.
Yeah, and to be honest, I'm being unfair to you by asking you to make a prediction or tell us your kind of gut instinct on it, because I think the real value in the paper that you've written is in outlining this general framework for thinking about it and not to foreclose our imagination from certain possibilities too soon, as you point out. And I think that's the real contribution here. So I think we'll leave it there. Thanks very much for joining me for this conversation.
Thanks very much for having me, John. I really enjoyed it.